I don't know of a more prolific author than John Feinstein. He's been on this show, I think this makes now 4 times in less than 2 years, and he's come out with his 4th book in less than 2 years. He's done Last Dance, Behind the Scenes of the Final Four. He did his first novel, Last Shot, a Final Four mystery, which was aimed at kind of a younger audience. Then we had him on talking about spending time with the Baltimore Ravens and his book Next Man Up, A Year Behind the Lines in Today's NFL. And this week he's out with another novel for younger readers. This one is called Vanishing Act, Mystery at the U.S. Open. You have 5 minutes free, John? You're not writing a new book right now?
For Paul, well, Paul, I believe it or not, I just finished a book on PGA Tour qualifying school.
Unbelievable.
That will be out next spring, which was a fascinating experience in itself. But for you, I always have, you know, even 10 minutes if needed.
Well, I appreciate that. My daughter's mad at you.
Uh-oh.
Well, actually, she's really mad at me.
Oh, well, that's better.
She's mad that I made her put your book down last night on page 215 and go to sleep. She loves it, just like she loved the first one, and already is asking me, are you going to write a 3rd one for kids?
Well, first of all, those are the reviews I love to hear, and the answer would be yes. I am, in fact, getting started on the third installment of Stevie and Susan Carroll, who are the two main characters in these books, and it'll be this time the setting will be the Super Bowl. So you can tell her, yes, there will be a 3rd installment, and I expect her to tell all her friends at school that they need to get their parents to go out and buy them Vanishing Act.
Yeah, I'm sure that that will be the way the word of mouth goes around.
I'm counting on that.
As opposed,
it worked in the first book.
You mean as opposed to lending them her copy?
We don't want that.
Lending is bad.
Lending is very bad. I, like you, have children to feed.
Now, speaking of kids, you have a lot of stuff because you're writing kid characters here. They're 8th graders.
Right. Well, they're about to go into 9th grade in this one, right.
Right. Did you have to get your kids to help you with stuff that would be more relatable to that peer group?
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, my 12-year-old son, Danny, who's a little younger but who is in that peer group, has been my editor on both Last Shot and Vanishing Act. And to give you a specific example, in the first chapter of Vanishing Act, Stevie and Susan Carroll are emailing one another. And as you know, since you have a daughter, there is very much an email slang or language,
yep,
that kids have when they are emailing back and forth that I'm not that familiar with, except for, what is it, P-L-O-S, parent looking over shoulder,
right,
which they will type to one another.
Or just P-O-S, parent over shoulder.
Parent over shoulder, P-O-S. And so I actually, Danny, when I finished the first chapter, went back through it and showed me all the places where I had screwed up and had not used the proper lingo or slang. So you very much, Danny has been help to me on both of these books.
And particularly in the text messaging, which is also part of that first chapter that you're talking about there and goes on throughout the book. It sounds to me like Danny should be sharing your Edgar Allan Poe Award. What is the Edgar Allan Poe Award?
You know, I had no idea what the Edgar Allan Poe Award was until last February when I got a call from my publisher at Random House to tell me that I was a finalist for the Edgar Allan Poe Award. And, you know, what do you do these days? I went online and found out that the Edgar Allan Poe Awards for mystery writing have been around for 60 years and that in the mystery writing genre, they're sort of the award, you know, that the great mystery writers going back to Raymond Chandler and people like that have won the Edgar Allan Poe Award.
Wow!
Yeah, and there are 3 categories. There's regular mystery. There's young adult, which was my category, and then there's a category for new mystery writers. And I was nominated in the young adult category and was thrilled to be nominated. And honestly, Paul, you've known me a long time. I don't think I stun that easily.
Yeah.
But at the dinner in New York in April, you know, I was sitting, this was funny because the 2 of the judges in my category came over to our table just before we were sitting down to dinner. I was there with my agent and my editor and some people from my publishing house, and it was a nice night. And they came over and they said, "You know, we loved your book. You should be very proud to be nominated." Now, what is that? What's the message there?
You lost.
Yeah, don't feel bad when you lost. Feel happy that you were nominated. So I'm sitting there, and they say, "And the winner is Last Shot." And I went, you know, it was what? It was a double take moment.
Yeah.
And I, of course, hadn't prepared anything to say, and so I was shocked and thrilled, and it's actually a pretty big time award. And when I brought the award is like this statue of Edgar Allan Poe, and when I brought it home, Danny decided that he should keep it in his room.
Well, so of course he did. Room. Yeah,
and I'm fine with that.
So in your long writing career, both as a sports writer and as an author, you had never drawn a direct line from Raymond Chandler to you?
Not really. Except, you know, I did watch Perry Mason as a kid.
Yeah.
But no, I had not thought of us. I certainly hadn't thought of myself in the same sense with Edgar Allan Poe, except, you know, the Ravens are named after
right.
the Raven. And did you know that the Ravens, the football team, have three mascots, Edgar Allan and Poe?
I did not know
which
that.
Which I think is kind of cool.
As far as I'm concerned, that's four mascots too many for any sports
team. Well, mascot sideline reporters, you're probably right. But. But the bottom, that was my closest connection to Edgar Allan Poe until this little statue came into our house.
Now, you mentioned Perry Mason. Speaking of old TV shows, as I was reading Vanishing Act, your new book, the plot is the most watched player in tennis, who's not Maria Sharapova, but Nadia Simonova.
Right. She bears resemblances to Maria Sharapova and Anna Kournikova.
Yes. She vanishes on the way from the locker room to the court at the U.S. Open.
Correct.
I remember an old Banachek episode where a player disappears right in the middle of the field and nobody can figure out how it happened or what was going on.
Really?
And as I'm reading this, I'm thinking to myself, wonder if John ever saw that old one.
No, I didn't. No, I wish I had.
I will tell you that you did not solve it the same way Banachek did.
Well, that's good. That's good. I'd like to think that I did at least come up with a new twist on what happened to Nadia Simonova. And you know, it was a lot of fun. You know, having been to 22 U.S. Opens, it was a lot of fun to write in a venue that I'm familiar with, much like with the Final Four with Last Shot.
Yep.
And to be able to work in some of my friends like Bud Collins and Mary Carrillo and people like that into the plot. I got a wonderful note from Mary yesterday about how much she enjoyed the book and said, in the note she said, you really caught what the Open's like, and you were much too kind to me, to which my response was, you can't be too kind to Mary.
Oh, that's
Mary's
nice.
The best. And in the book, you know, where Stevie says to Mary, my dad thinks you're hot.
Uh-huh.
Well, that comes pretty directly from his creator. And Mary knows that, of course.
Yeah. You don't have anything in there about McEnroe, though.
McEnroe makes a
no,
a,
no. I mean in that in that regard. I mean, nobody's saying going up to John McEnroe and saying my mom thinks you're hot.
That does not occur in the book. You're absolutely correct about that. And but both McEnroes do make cameo appearances in the book, but they're not main characters the way Mary and Bud are, because Mary and Bud are very close friends.
Will you be in Flushing this weekend spending a couple of weeks there at the U.S. Open?
No, I'm too old to spend 2 weeks at the U.S. Open. I did my duty there. When I was at the Washington Post, but I'll be there for the first few days, and depending on how the second week plays out, I might go back for the semis and the final. If Agassi were to make it to the last weekend, I would go back for that.
Yeah, this is a big deal because it's Andre Agassi's last stand, isn't it?
It is, and he will be the focal point of the tennis tournament until he stops playing, whenever that is, if it's in the first round or if it's in the final, He has been a wildly popular player throughout his career, and the last 10 years or so, he's deserved the popularity. You know, Bud Collins had the best line on Agassi when he announced his retirement at Wimbledon. He said he went from punk to paragon.
Right.
And I think that's very apt. Andre, when I was covering tennis full-time in the late 80s, early 90s, Andre was a complete pain in the butt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was selfish, he was mean-spirited, he was phony. You know, he skipped Wimbledon 3 years in a row so he could play on clay court tournaments in Europe and take under-the-table guarantees. You remember when he spit on the umpire in 1990 at the U.S. Open? He was a punk. And to his everlasting credit, he outgrew it. He became a champion when he was a choker early in his career, ended up winning 8 Grand Slams with chance for one more, won all 4 majors. Only 4 players in history have done that. And more importantly, he became a good man. You know, he's obviously devoted to his family now. He's done an incredible amount of work for charity. And I remember a couple of years ago when Yevgeny Kafelnikov came into a U.S. Open press conference and whined about the fact that the players weren't making enough money. Agassi came in right after that, and somebody repeated the line to him, and he said, "Did he really say that?" And then he went off on, you know, how lucky are we that we get paid this kind of money to play tennis, and he ought to shut up.
Yeah, what a difference.
Yeah, and I turned to somebody and I said, Andre Agassi's become the conscience of tennis. We've got a problem. but it's true.
Yeah. Well, it's ironic. We're talking with John Feinstein, author of Vanishing Act, Mystery at the U.S. Open, here on the Paul Harris Show on KMOX. It's ironic that Andre Agassi has become the statesman of tennis, and John McEnroe, has become the statesman in the booth. I mean, he is a great spokesperson for the game, and I think of all the people doing color commentary, including your friend Tony Kornheiser, who we'll talk about in a moment here, I think he does the best color commentary and analysis in sports.
I think it's a toss-up between John and Mary. And the interesting thing is they work together for
right.
CBS during the U.S. Open, and I think they're great. And, of course, you know they grew up together in Queens. They were buddies growing up and won two mixed doubles titles, Grand Slam mixed doubles titles, together as kids. So that's how far back they go. But, yeah, I agree with you about McEnroe. I'll tell you an interesting story about that. In 1990, when I was researching my nonfiction tennis book, Hard Courts, one of the people I leaned on heavily for guidance was Arthur Ashe, for obvious reasons. Arthur was not only the Davis Cup captain and a great player, but he was the conscience of tennis and perhaps the conscience of sports while he was still alive. And I said to Arthur, is there anybody, because this was before he'd been diagnosed with AIDS, but he'd already had a couple heart attacks and had some health issues. And I said, is there anybody who could come along and take your place in doing what you do in tennis? He said, yeah, there's one person who could do it. It's McEnroe. And I kind of did a double take. And I said, because I knew John, and John is always very bright, but also completely out of his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, McEnroe? He said, absolutely. He's smart enough, and he does have the soul to do that, to be the guy who says the right things and is the leader on issues that are important. And I've talked to him about it. And if you go back to Hard Courts, which is now 15 years old, and read it, I quoted Arthur saying that. And I remember asking John if he felt that was possible back then. And John said, you know, that's a lot of pressure, but if Arthur thinks I can do it, maybe I ought to think about it. Here we are 15 years later.
Yeah. We talked about this being Agassi's last stand. Is this also Martina Navratilova's last stand?
Well, at least for now.
I mean,
she makes her next comeback.
She's the same age I am. She's 48 years old.
No, she's 49. She's older than you. She'll
wow.
50 in October.
Holy cow.
And she just won a doubles tournament last week in Toronto. She is an extraordinary athlete. And person, this will be, she has said this will be her last tournament, that she's going to retire from playing doubles after this, and she'll be 50 in October. And if she were to get deep into the tournament in doubles or mixed doubles, obviously there'd be a good deal of attention focused on that, and there should be.
I agree, because, you know, I think she goes down as one of the top 5-10 athletes of all time.
No question, a breakthrough athlete, took women's tennis to another level athletically. In terms of conditioning, she forced Chris Evert to get better late in her career so that Chris could compete with her. She won 18 singles titles, Grand Slam singles titles, countless doubles titles. I don't even know what the number is right now, but it's like in the 50s. Was also very much a breakthrough athlete in that she, you know, came out and admitted she was gay early on in her career, and has become very much a spokeswoman for women's rights and gay rights and all sorts of political issues.
Yeah, I expect that she will retire after the U.S. Open and in 3 years come back and box George Foreman.
Probably win.
Probably, yes.
Because she'll be in better shape than George, I guarantee you that.
Yeah, well, she doesn't have the grill, that's why. all right, let's talk about your colleague and longtime friend, Tony Kornheiser. Monday Night Football, his debut a couple of weeks ago. We had him on. He called in last week while he was on the bus from Minneapolis to Shreveport and called Paul Farhi, his Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to use the word colleague, but they both work at the paper,
they
as you know.
They both work at the paper.
Paul had taken some shots at him,
yep.
and Tony called him a two-bit weasel.
Yeah.
You know,
see,
these guys.
Leave it to Tony, when he got all good reviews, except for one, to make sure that everybody focuses on the one bad review.
Is he a little bit too thin-skinned, do you think?
I love Tony. I have known Tony 25 years. We have been colleagues. We have been friends. His daughter was the flower girl in my wedding.
Mm-hmm.
So, and last year when I started this charity golf tournament in Bruce Edwards' name, Tony and Wilbon were the MCs. So we're old dear friends.
Right.
And I have said to him for years, you have to stop being Don Imus, you know, and killing everybody who criticizes you in any way, because it makes you look smaller. And you are a big, important guy, and you don't need to get down to the level that these people are at when they criticize you. And I say that as someone who's gotten some bad reviews in my day for my books. I've been very lucky. Most of my reviews have been very good. But there have been some bad reviews. I mean, there was a guy when I wrote Last Dance who wrote in the New York Times that I was so bad I should never write again. So what am I going to do? Am I going to go around and take shots at the guy and make it look like I'm obsessing about that review when all the other reviews were good and the book was on the bestseller list?
No, but do you think...
No, because that gives him pleasure.
Right, but do you think Tony should have expected that the writers on his own newspaper would have kid gloves?
No, he shouldn't have, because it never works that way. That's just not the way life is, not at the Washington Post. And the only place I will say that kid gloves its own people a little bit is the New York Times Book Review.
Mm.
You will never see a bad review of a New York Times book in the New York Times Book Review. I remember the Detroit Free Press killing a bad review of Mitch Albom's second book. But the Washington Post ain't the Detroit Free Press. It's just not going to do that. And having said that, do I understand Tony's frustration? Yes, absolutely, I understand it. But what he should be focusing on is the fact that virtually all the reviews were good. I thought he did very well. I think they have too many voices. They need to get rid of the sideline reporters. That's not a shot at Michelle or Susie. It's a shot at sideline reporters. And that once he and Tirico and Theismann get used to the rhythms of working with one another, I think they're going to do very well.
He also has to learn to jump in when Joe inhales, which is not very often.
Jump in fast. but Tony knew that going in. That's Joe.
Yeah.
That's who Joe is.
Yep.
And he understands that. And the thing, people have asked me a million times since Tony got hired, do I think he's going to succeed? And my answer is, has he ever failed at anything he's taken on? The answer is no. He's been a great newspaper guy. He was a great radio guy. He's a great co-host on PTI. That's the only good show ESPN has.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he'll do very well at Monday Night Football. Yeah. And he just needs, when he gets the occasional bad review, to shut up.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I've known Tony a long time. He and I,
you guys started together in 1992 at TEM.
That's right. We worked together, and he was on my show even before that. So it was nice of him to call in last week. And it's always a pleasure having you on. I'm glad you were on the show today. We're already scheduling here. The PGA book, we'll have you back on in the spring.
I'll look forward to
it. And then next fall, we'll have you on for Stevie and Susan book number 3.
Only if your daughter gives me a good review.
And then the spring after that, we have you down for a roller hockey book.
Tiddlywinks.
There you go.
Tiddlywinks.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Yeah. John Feinstein, his new book, a young adult book. My daughter is eating it up. She's going to be mad at me when she comes home from school this afternoon because I have the book here and she won't be able to read it till I get home tonight and finish up those last few pages. It's called Vanishing Act, Mystery at the U.S. Open. John Feinstein here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.